Good morning, and thanks for joining us. Today, Wednesday, April 24th, this is The Morning Show on 88.5 KRFY, and I'm one of your hosts this morning. I'm Susie Prez.
I'm a co-host sitting over here, Susie. Chris Bessler, how are you today?
I'm doing well, and how are you?
I'm great. It's a beautiful day again, beautiful spring day out there after just a glorious Easter Sunday we had. Did you do anything fun on Easter?
You know, just being outside and breathing the air and working in the garden was fun.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Everything was good.
We went for a bike ride out in Hope along the old Hope Highway or along the lake there. It was just beautiful.
Perfect.
Yep. Yeah. And so what's going on today?
Well, lots of things. Do we want to hear the weather first?
Well, first of all, let's let folks know we have a great interview coming with the all three of our District 1 legislators. And that's going to come up in about 4 minutes. We actually taped it yesterday, got into a whole bunch of issues with them. We taped it because we needed to coordinate schedules with the three of them. But they'll give us a lowdown on what happened in Boise.
And, you know, I really want to say thank you to the legislators, Representative Sage Dixon and Representative Heather Scott and Senator Jim Woodward, for taking the time to come in and really speak to some issues and their stand and what it was like down in Boise for this 2019 legislative session. And it was very insightful. So that's coming up, and we will be playing that in just a few minutes.
Yeah. But first, what's happening with the weather?
Oh, from the National Weather Service, currently it's 46 degrees, partly cloudy. We can expect a high today of 65 and a low tonight of 36. So those bright, clear days bring us a little bit cooler evenings. And tomorrow, partly sunny, high of 65, a few more clouds coming in, and a low of 42 on Thursday night. It looks like on the weekend, possibly 40 to 30% showers. But you know how that is. They come and go.
They come and go. It's spring. Classic spring weather. Really beautiful out there. A few other things happening outside. The sunrise this morning was at 5:41 a.m. It'll set tonight at 7:48 p.m. The days are getting longer. Over the course of the past week, we've picked up 23 minutes of daylight per day, which is pretty cool. The lake is now, they're starting to fill the lake at the Albany Falls Dam there, and it has come up 1.15 feet in the past 7 days. It's at 2054, so they have another 8 feet or so to get up to full pool level. But before long, people will be getting out on the lake. And our rivers, we're seeing spring runoff now in our rivers, some of the ones where people do whitewater rafting and kayaking. The Moye River is running at 1550 CFS. That's cubic feet per second right now. It's actually doubled its stream flow in the last week, due to all the runoff coming in. Priest River now is at 2,800 cubic feet per second. It's up 230 cubic feet per second in just the last week. So the spring is happening all over the place out there. I want to mention one other springtime thing that's happening is that the Sandpoint Osprey Cam is going. It was actually out of commission there for a couple months, and this is something that I'm personally involved with, and we were able to get up to the camera, get the big bucket truck. The camera's 100 feet up at Memorial Field, so it's really quite a big project to get up to it. Got the big bucket truck out there, replaced the camera. The picture now of the Osprey is a live web stream. We have the Osprey nest up there. It's better than ever. The sound is better than ever. We're really thrilled about it. Huge props to Carrie Berg at Video Surveillance Technology. He donated his time and expertise to do that replacement. Dennis McIntyre of Best Way Tree Service, he's the guy that brings out that bucket truck, only one in the whole region that can get up there. And of course, City Parks and Recreation, they totally facilitate everything. They're great. And this is a project of sandpointonline.com. You can see it if you go to sandpointonline.com and just click on the picture of the ospreys on the front page, or direct link is sandpointospreys.com. And it's pretty cool to see those beautiful birds up there.
You know, it's really, and yes, thank you to Sandpoint Online and all the folks that you mentioned, because there's nothing like watching what's going on up there. So where are they at? Are they starting to build a nest?
Oh, they have. It's great. Well, we really had a very small window to get up there and fix that after the snow was off the field and the field firmed up. The ospreys arrived back, we think, around April 11th. You know, we got up there last week, just a little over a week after they were back. And they already have the nest substantially built. So, heck, eggs could arrive any day now.
So if you go to that webcam, you can maybe even see those eggs show up.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, there's always a ton of people that tune in about the time they're laying their eggs. And then they lay on them until they hatch, and then there's the whole drama of the whole season that
the fledging.
And there's a chat feature on the page, so people come in and they watch and they trade comments about the things they're seeing, and you learn a lot of stuff about ospreys.
And there's an expert bird person that gives commentary and talks about the stages that they're in, their development, and things like that, which is always very interesting, too, so you kind of know what's going on.
Yeah. Let's mention Janie Veltkamp. She's the director of the Birds of Prey Northwest. She's a consulting biologist. She keeps an eye and helps us ensure the safety and health of those osprey. So Birds of Prey Northwest, another really terrific organization we have around here.
Great. And, you know, there's webcams, bird webcams all over the country. Last year I was watching some owls nesting and baby owls being born. It was quite amazing. Of course, I like the ospreys of Sandpoint the best. So this is from Jennifer Stapleton, our city administrator. This is your Sandpoint City Minute for today. The city has retained the services of Green Play, a national parks, recreation, and open space consulting firm to assist with the development of a new parks and recreation master plan. The city and Green Play will host an open public forum next Thursday, May 2nd, from 6 to 7:30. Please join us and provide your input on the needs of the community for parks, recreation, facilities, services, and programs. The location of the forum will be announced later today on the city website, Facebook page, and Engage Sandpoint app. That's from Jennifer Stapleton. Thanks, Jennifer, for that Sandpoint City Minute.
Yeah, and it's a chance for people to get involved with what's happening with that. We got to get into the recorded interview with the legislators right now. Just want to mention there's some great things going on around town. One is the Wine Festival at Sandpoint, big fundraiser for the festival at Sandpoint. That's Saturday. Next week, May 4th, there's a murder mystery dinner that the Sandpoint Rotary is putting on. It's called A Dinner to Die For. It's an evening of mystery. Great dinner at Tango Cafe. And
it's time for our legislative recording interview. And Senator Woodward, Representative Scott, and Dixon, thank you so much for talking with us today. The news coming out of Boise, the 2019 legislative session was one to write home about. We have a lot of questions to cover, but to kick it off, we'd like to ask each of you to give us your take on the 2019 legislative session and what you felt were some of the significant achievements, as well as things you believe might have gone better. Just to start by alphabet, Representative Dixon, you can go first, and please aim for 5 minutes or less.
Thank you, Susie, and thank you, Chris. It's always nice to be here with you, and I appreciate you giving us this opportunity to speak to our constituents that we might not normally have. I think we try to get in touch with everybody during the session with town halls and things, but I know it's difficult for people to come out, so this is a great opportunity for us to reach out and express some of the things that we experienced to those who are listening, which is appreciated. This year, it was an interesting year. I will agree. It's something to write home about. It started off pretty slow. I think the three of us have talked about it before, that it seemed like things were going to be moving at a much slower pace. And I attributed that mainly to the new administration, to Governor Little. We had 12 years of Governor Otter. This was a new governor. We had new agency heads. There were 5 or 6 new chairmen in the House. There were some new chairmen in the Senate. Always new members. This was a relatively large class in the House. I don't know if the Senate was that large, but a lot of newness within the building in itself. And so I think there was some hesitancy. There was an unfamiliarity with some people, with each other, and what the governor's office was going to do. And so it started off slower than normal. We do have the rules review that we do the first 3 weeks, and that was pretty standard. But what I noticed mainly was that the agencies weren't bringing forth as much legislation as they normally did. And that, again, I've attributed that to the new leadership within the executive branch. New chairmen were handling things differently in the House. That slowed things down a little bit as well on our side of the building. And it just seemed like it would be a much slower pace, markedly lower from my experience, this being my fifth year in the legislature. But somewhere near the middle to end of February, that all changed, and it sped up quite a bit. And when we look at the final numbers now, we were just maybe five or six pieces of legislation off what we did last year and previous years, and right in the ballpark of what we've been doing, with roughly 800 bills printed, 500 bills or so coming before committees and onto the floor. And it was a pretty standard year in the end. So there was a lot crammed in to the end, and that's usually where a lot of the activity happens also. Even though we start things in the beginning, in order to work things through both sides of the building, trying to get a feel for how it's going to go. Sometimes a lot of the larger issues end up coming at the end, and people get a little tense. We're ready to go home, especially the farmers. They see snow's gone from the fields, or it's time to start planting, and even us up here wanting to just get home. You know, there's a time when you've fought these battles for 3 months and nothing's going anywhere, so let's call it off. And I at least felt that this year. This was one of the years that I felt I was ready to go home. So that was a little bit different in doing that. And those larger issues that came through, and of course we had the Prop 2 issue and then how we were going to approach Medicaid expansion. So there were many, many conversations about that throughout the whole session, and it came to a head at the end. There was some transportation funding issues. The other large issue, I'm sure Senator Woodward can talk about this a little more, but was the public school funding formula. And that was an interim committee that I sat on for 3 years, and we did a lot of work for 3 years in bringing everybody to the table and discussing this and coming forward with some legislation that we thought was good legislation that didn't appear to be such good legislation when it finally came before the legislature. There was still a lot of concern by stakeholders, the different districts around the state, and that kind of fell by the wayside, and that was a disappointment, but there were some positives that came out of that as well, and I think we'll continue to head in the direction that we started, but we just weren't able to make that work stick this year. And then we have had for the past 4 years something that's called the Strategic Initiatives Index regarding transportation, and that would take a portion of our surplus revenue and put it directly into roads, both for the state and localities, and that's been a real strong boon to our local districts in getting projects done. And it sunsetted. 2 years ago, it sunsetted. We kept it going. Now this year was another sunset, and it got caught up in all the negotiations of other funding and different things like that. And we tried to make a larger change overall for transportation funding that it got caught up in. And so we lost that. So I think that's unfortunate. I'm hoping we can get it back next year, but that was disappointing to me because it was great to get money right onto our roads as a state, but also really helped out our localities. District 1 did fantastic last year with receiving over $3 million because of the way that was set up. And so we want to keep that going. But unfortunately, it became a casualty in some other battles this year.
Well, thank you, Representative Dixon. And some of those issues that you brought up, we'll cover a little bit more in depth as we go along here. And Representative Scott, it's your turn. And the question is, what were some of the achievements that you felt the 2019 legislative session accomplished, and what you believe might have gone better, and just in general?
So it was a new year with a new governor, and the mood is different. I think people were tired of what we had, and everyone's kind of waiting and seeing to give this new governor a chance and see, you know, in the past, literally to where it got after 12 years with Governor Otter, is the executive branch was pretty much in control of the entire legislature, in my opinion. What the executive branch wanted, they got. And it was this top-down approach, and it was just a top-down, top-heavy. And this year, I think everyone's trying to figure out where their place is. And there was a little more tension between the House and Senate, maybe buying for the new governor's attention. I think there wasn't, you know, this governor doesn't seem as heavy-handed to start with. Maybe they all start that way, start nice and end up heavy-handed. But what do we know? Power corrupts, absolutely. So so we have to remember all power's in the people. And so when we stick with that and we start to look at government through those eyes, which is what I like to look at, the people should have the most power. And as you go to the different branches, it should be less and less going up. And so, but as we know, if you don't exercise your power, someone will gladly step into that role. And so the governor has not stepped into that role. People have been very engaged this year. There were a lot of, you know, of course, the Medicaid, the Prop 2 was a huge overlying, you know, issue. And we talked about it a little bit in the beginning, but literally most of those conversations were done behind closed doors. The insurance companies, the health and welfare department, the key players, all kind of working things out on what this was going to look like, how it was going to be funded. And so it really, where you think that we should have been talking about that all year and debating it, and really you didn't hear a lot about it, even through the caucuses, until the last 2 weeks of session. So that's something I noticed that was key. A lot of things just kind of sat to the wayside. And I always warn constituents, watch those last 2 weeks, because that's when things slip through. School funding formula, they worked on that all session. And coming from a scientific background and dealing a lot with modeling, with water issues and stuff, models are just for that. I mean, they're to kind of get an idea, to look at something through a different lens of eyes. And I think what I saw is they're trying to take the model outcome and turn it into legislation. And models are kind of made to be fluent. You try this and see what it turns out to be, and you try this, that. And so that never really got anywhere this year. And I think that's probably why, because every time you pump something different into the formula, you got a different result. And some people liked it and some people didn't, so they'd repump something back into the formula. Marcy's Law was a big deal, and that has been lobbied on the legislature. I think this has gone on the third year, and it's been a statewide campaign. There's signs everywhere. It's being sold as a victim's right bill, but I think this year people started to realize this is red flag laws for guns, and this is a backdoor attempt to come after that. And something that came to light is this year for me that I wish I would have known before, it was public information, but the guy actually behind this, a billionaire out of California, has a rap sheet, a pretty long rap sheet. So that all came to light this year. And I think when people start getting more details of where this is really stemming from, they backed off. And so it was nice to see that killed in the Senate this year for once. Usually it's the House that has to do the heavy lifting. One thing I did notice this year, and the Senate, you know, the House, we've been making great progress in getting more bills for the people and more citizen bills. And the Senate just continues to sit on these bills, and they refuse to hear them. I do believe that the House, we're starting to see things move through the system better. Most bills are given a hearing. I had a couple bills that were denied a hearing, but for the most part, all my ideas or all the citizen ideas that I ran were given a hearing. And so now they're being stopped on the Senate side. So there's definitely some more work to do on the Senate side. I don't know if we'll have time to talk about our individual bills, but I'll just, will we?
Later.
Later.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I will just end it there. Okay.
And now, our new Senator Woodward, as Representative Dixon said a while ago at a different interview, you now have a voting record. So, and you have experience. Your first session, the 2019 legislative session, what was it like for you? What did you see as significant achievements and things that could have gone better?
Good morning. So first off, I am on a steady diet of cough drops here. I apologize for my voice, and I'll try not to cough into the microphone. My first year yet, yes, my first year, and there was a lot of discussion about it being a contentious year, but for me now it's the norm. So my only exposure to it, but I did hear that people felt it was a little bit more contentious this year than possibly in the past. A couple of things, just small things that we worked on this year, the surveyor right of access, that was a little bit of a cleanup. Actually started in on that project at the request of a local surveyor with one of the companies here in town, and made good progress on that because that had been stopped last year in the Senate side of the legislature. So we started there and guaranteed our surveyor's right of access, because without property boundaries, you can't have property rights. And so that was something we got taken care of. Couple other local things that came through that I voted on, of course, and was involved in the conversation, but didn't work on a whole bunch. But historic theaters in Idaho, 13 or 17 historic theaters can serve alcohol, so that's the Panada. So the Panada, you can go out at intermission and have a beer out there. The other one for another local business that affects another local business is Contract Brewing, and McDuff's has been involved in that, and early on Representative Dixon had been speaking with them, and so a piece of legislation that allows one small brewer, if they have enough capacity, to help another small brewer, and just because before it was illegal for one to brew for another if they're trying to get another product out there and they had capacity. The small brewers are defined by the number of barrels per year, or gallons per year. So that's a great one for the small brewers in the state. And then to go back to that transportation piece where the strategic initiatives, what that does for us locally this year, that the some of the leftover money that came out of last year's budget and was put to local projects, well, that's repaving the Schweitzer Road this year. So I think everybody will look forward to that. And $1 million to go on the Schweitzer Road, $1 million to go to downtown Priest River, and then some smaller amounts, $600,000 and $300,000 amounts for Bonner County, Boundary County, and I think it was either Kootenai or Pondere that picked up another grant. And so that's that surplus, or the money left over at the budget, where half of it goes in the stabilization fund and half of it goes to transportation. But as Representative Dixon said, that piece of legislation didn't get extended. That was a five-year piece of legislation, and so we'll go back with every intent to try and put that project or that program back in place. So those are a couple of things that I was involved in. I also worked with the city of Sandpoint, and so did Representative Dixon, on the what's really a local option sales tax for resort cities. Sandpoint is one of about 14 cities in the small towns in the state of Idaho that qualify as a resort city under some 1980s or 70s legislation. And so that allows the bed tax here in town. And at some point that'll go away unless something's taken care of. But that was really a learning lesson for me as a freshman, to see who has strong feelings about local option taxes, because that's the resort tax is a local option tax, and found out where some of the roadblocks are on making changes there. I'm smiling at my counterparts here because they know who I'm referring to. And then, so I sat on the finance committee this year, which is a joint finance and appropriations committee, 10 House members and 10 Senate members on the finance committee. And we did go through that budget and appropriated $8.9 billion this year. So that's a balanced budget based on projections. That's a lot of money to take a look at. That process is 6 weeks of hearing the agencies and 3 weeks of going back. There's a lot of groundwork that happens throughout the year. So that was just an understanding, go through that system was quite a bit to learn. But I think that we'll start to make some changes in that come next year. We've already got a couple things there. Finally, the education funding formula, that was changing the funding formula is just that, it's change. And what we found out is that nobody likes change. Every time you propose a change, somebody says, this is bad for me for this reason. And so at the end, what we did was come up with a piece of legislation that simply set in place the definitions and some data acquisition account, some enrollment counts for next year, so that we can make that good comparison. Because every time that we got to the point where somebody said, this is wrong, or this change is no good, somebody else would say, well, that data is no good. And so we're going to take a look at enrollment as compared to average daily attendance.
Okay, well, thank you all three for that introduction. So we're going to dig in on some questions now. And Sage, you're going to be first up because the first issue we have to talk about is Senate Bill 1159, which is basically would put some restrictions on the citizen initiative process, or reformat that anyways. It was certainly one of the most contentious issues. It got a lot of attention up here. To give some background on that, this was sponsored by Senator Scott Groh of Eagle, Idaho, down near Boise. And his bill would have increased the number of signatures required for an initiative, a referendum, to get on the ballot from 6% of the registered voters in 18 of Idaho's 35 legislative districts up to 10% in 32 of the 35 legislative districts, and it would also cut down the amount of time allowed to gather signatures from 18 months currently to just 6 months. Senator Woodward and Representative Scott opposed this bill. We'll swing back to them, but Representative Dixon, you supported it. Now, Governor Brad Little vetoed the bill, and then Representative Dixon, you came back with basically the same measure split up into four different bills. I think that would be accurate to characterize it that way. And those bills ultimately didn't advance, so the legislation is dead for this year. I guess first question would be, why did you so actively support this legislation?
Oh, thank you, Chris. I felt it was important. If we're going to be going around our established process of making law through elected representation, then I thought that our current process of the ballot initiative was limited in scope about who would have a say in what was going to be put on the ballot, and that then in turn also would be skewed as far as how those votes might go. So my intent was to make sure that more people in Idaho had a voice on the lawmaking process the way they do through elected representation, and that's why I carried that bill. And I still feel that that's the right way to go in doing that. I ran those other four bills because the governor's issue and the reason he vetoed it was because, as an aggregate, that's where the difficulty was, his lawyers felt, in going before Judge Windmill here, our federal judge in Idaho, and then also then going to the Ninth Circuit should we appeal. So there were some easy parts of 1159, and the more difficult parts were the ones that you mentioned, and it seemed appropriate to attempt, and we had some agreement with the Senate going into that effort in attempting to break it up into four separate bills, to put them forward individually, let the legislature choose if there were ones that they felt more appropriate than others, and then if they were all appropriate, send them to the governor, and then he could select also which ones he thought were maybe more appropriate than others, and then in turn, if he didn't veto any of those, then the opponents could choose which ones they wanted to sue over, because that's the direction we were headed, I think, regardless of what we tried to do in doing that. But one of them we heard on the House floor, but again, the Senate just, I think the good senator here told me we ran out of time, but they backed away as soon as we went through that effort of getting those passed through the committee. The Senate then got back to us and said they weren't going to hear them. So that was a bit frustrating for me. I don't like to do things just to do them. But that's why I supported that process.
Okay, well, we're going to dig in on a few aspects of it here. So right now, it's really pretty difficult to get an initiative on the ballot. And to give some context here, in 2018, of course, we had two initiatives. These are, you know, campaigns by citizens to put forth a ballot measure that the whole state can vote on. One was for Medicaid expansion, and one was for historical horse racing. Medicaid expansion passed, historical horse racing did not pass. And that was just in 2018. In 2016, there were three citizen initiatives that were circulated around the state. None met the threshold to make it on the ballot. In 2014, there were two initiatives that were attempted, and they didn't make it on the ballot. And that goes to the fact that it is pretty difficult right now to meet that threshold, to gather all this the signatures that are required around the state. So with it already rather difficult for citizens to get an initiative onto the ballot, what is the problem with the current rules?
I'm just saying what I said again. It's more of a philosophical argument for me, but I think there's also some practical arguments to be made there, that there are groups that make a lot of money off of helping get ballot initiatives passed, and it's the business that they have and do, and targeting with all the data harvesting that we have, they're able to target where you can go get those signatures. One of the things that we showed was specifically a map of Idaho about those two initiatives and where the signature gathering efforts took place and where they were able to accomplish them, and they were almost carbon copies of each other, being two very different issues. And I will continue to say, if we're going to go around that process, yes, this was put into the Constitution, oh, goodness, I'm forgetting all my facts now, but I believe it was in 1912, and then it took until 1930 until it was put at 10% at that point. Nothing happened for the first 20 years, but as a result of the progressive movement in the early 1900s, a lot of states in the West had this placed into their constitution. And it wasn't the original intent, though. We have it. That's fine. But it should be more reflective of the state as a whole, not specific targeted districts within the state. So although others didn't make it, that was my intent in trying to protect that.
Just a quick question. Mm-hmm. It was my understanding from everything I read, heard, and really looking at the Reclaim Idaho's attempt and success at getting enough signatures to get the Medicaid expansion Proposition 2 on the ballot, and that they really didn't take any outside funds. There was a small group that came in at the very end and got a couple thousand signatures just to put them over, which they were pretty much far over. And it was a nonpartisan effort. It was grassroots. It went into the rural areas, went into the big cities, and that might be part of the concern that you have, these concentrated areas of citizens in, say, Ada County. But it was spread out over the state. Is that what you found, too, that it was pretty balanced in its attempt and its success in getting signatures that really didn't, that made it a true citizens' initiative?
I will say, first off, I think a lot of people are assuming that it was Prop 2 that motivated this, and it certainly wasn't for me. This is something that I've had on a list of legislative ideas for a while now, and it does, I can see the tie there, but that wasn't the specific motivation. I think where they did go was areas where they thought they would have the most success, and they did have the most success. And that's what I was talking about with those two maps, because the Prop 1 proponents went to different areas where they thought they'd have the most success, and they did as well. So it's this targeting to make it easier to get those signatures and doing that, and thereby leaving out many, many citizens within our state. And then those areas where you're getting the signatures, it's not a hard step to take to say that, well, that's where those votes are going to come from also, and they're already primed to vote for something if they're signing it on a ballot initiative. And then, especially in the larger population areas, that's going to mean that those folks who aren't in those areas and gathering the signatures are not going to have a say in what's going on in doing that. So good for them if they went everywhere. I appreciate that. They should go everywhere. But where those signatures came from were very different than where the other signatures came from.
So let's follow up on that a little bit. Not to be lost in the overall conversation here is the fact that this is just to get a proposition on the ballot. The state citizens then get to vote on it and decide whether that would be passed. In last year, voters rejected one and approved one. So doesn't that give rural voters basically the final say in anything that gets proposed by other citizens?
They can vote, but they'll easily be outvoted by those that are putting it on the ballot. If you're going to those major population areas and collecting most of your votes and priming them to vote for something at that point, then they will be easily outvoted. Their interests won't be weighed in doing that. And now we'll go back to that's the way we were originally structured as a nation and a state. It was to have equal representation through the voice, people's voice of electing their representatives, so that in our representative bodies, everybody has an equal voice at that point, not a strict democracy where it's just the sheer 50 plus one win.
Okay, well, I'm going to follow up on another aspect there. So this movement would make the initiative process more restrictive, but that makes it harder for all citizens to get a ballot initiative passed, including rural citizens. So how is it a benefit to rural citizens who want to put something forward onto the ballot to also put them through a much more restrictive process to get legislation that they want on the ballot? Posed.
I think it would be equal for regardless of who wants to run that ballot initiative process. Whether you live in an urban area or a rural area, you'll have to follow the same process. At this point, it's easier to ignore those rural areas.
Okay, I'm going to ask just one more question, and then we're going to have Senator Woodward and Representative Scott come on board with this question. One thing that came up in the course of all the dialogue and a lot of publicity and a lot of social media talk about this thing was there was a huge outpouring of public comment, and it was overwhelmingly opposed to Senate Bill 1151, which was out there longer before the four bills came along. And I don't have the most recent numbers on this. I did some research last night. But of those testifying before the Senate committee on Senate Bill 1151, 25 of 26 of those testifying opposed it. And then after it passed, it got out of committee by one vote. After it passed, the Idaho Statesman reported that the governor's office received 4,644 phone calls and emails, of which 4,611 asked the governor to veto it, and only 33 of them asked him to sign it. So overwhelming opposition in terms of public comment. How do you reconcile such a strong response in the public comment with your position, which... And it seems like it's not paying attention to that public comment.
Well, majority of those people were from Boise. And when they stated where, who they were and where they were from, so that speaks to a little bit of the major cities participating more than the rural areas in doing that. And I will say usually those folks are more active than the folks on the right. If we say the folks on the left that are opposed to this, which is odd to me, don't know why, but they're far more active and they have a better network of getting things done. And the media also gives them more exposure generally. And that's what we saw. There were polls out there and other people saying things that were in favor of it, but we didn't hear anything about that. And so I think the perception is that the majority of the state is against that. But I'll say a majority of the people that probably came to testify were against it. Absolutely. There's no doubt about that.
Okay. Well, Representative Dixon, thanks for taking the questions. But let's bring in now our other two legislators here. Representative Scott, you voted against the bill. What's your take on it?
I have a little different take on it. I do believe it was a direct attack on the people. The people worked hard to get the Medicaid expansion on the ballot. That is, according to Article 3, Section 1 of our Constitution, says the people reserve to themselves the power to approve or reject at the polls any act or measure passed by the legislature. Now, just because the legislature may not like what they got on the ballot, it does go for a vote for the entire state. And I love the language. It's the voter's revenge bill. It didn't seem to me anything but a voter's revenge bill. And if you look at the sponsors of that bill, it's the establishment and the machine that ran that bill because they're terrified what might come next on the ballot. And I think I've said this in testimony, I've said it in my article, it's a lot easier to control 105 legislators than it is to control the people. And every lobbyist out there was in favor of this bill. But I didn't hear hardly any testimony, and I was in the committee in the House that this went through. I didn't hear hardly any testimony in favor of this bill, but it was an establishment-run leadership bill, and that was obvious. It's already hard to do. It's hard to put something on the ballot, and I do not believe that this makes it easier for rural areas. I didn't buy that argument from the beginning. I questioned that argument. It just didn't make sense to me. So that's kind of where I stood on it. If we don't like something in the Constitution, let's go after the Constitution. Let's not make something so hard that you can't allow the Constitution to work. Or let's not ignore the Constitution. And I believe that what this bill would have done is made it so hard that you could not get something on the ballot. And the argument that, you know, only the rich, so when we do this and we make it almost impossible for the grassroots groups, what we're going to have is the really rich people, whether it's George Soros or the Koch brothers, either side you're on, they're going to be coming and running our state instead of your legislators and the people running this state.
Representative Scott, thank you. And Senator Woodward, same question to you. You voted against the bill. What's your position?
Well, I was taking a look back at how we got to initiatives and referendums. You know, we put this in our Constitution in about 1912 or 1913, and to date, I think it's worked well. We just, in local time or recent times, we've seen the Luna laws by referendum were taken away or rejected by the voters. Medicaid expansion was passed, and then the other initiative this time around was the horse racing, and I think that was an example of what there was big money. There was about $6 million on each side of that argument, and it does, once they're on the ballot, I will make a point that once something's on the ballot, it does become just a campaign, and so there does need to be an adequate process to make sure that not everything gets on the ballot. And we see it, we do see a nationwide movement to use ballot initiatives more. And so I think that having the conversation about it, is our process adequate and correct, is a worthwhile conversation. What I focused on And it was part of some of this initial legislation. I think that, one, knowing where, if you propose legislation, what is the cost of it? And two, where, what is the potential source of that revenue to, or the tax money? How do you pay for it? So I think that there's a lot of validity in that. And then after that, I kind of went off on a little bit different tack, because I think we should be looking at paper signature. Where a lot of people are getting paid to collect signatures, and you get it constitutionally, you have to allow people to get paid, but not pay per signature. And so we in Idaho, prior to 2001, you could not pay per signature on a ballot petition, and that was struck down in a court case. But yet there are other states in the country where it's been upheld. Oregon prohibits pays per signature, and actually has other rules in place that if you want to collect signatures, you have to go through a little bit of training. You have to be registered with the state, just like a candidate is registered. And so I think that 20 years down the road from when we lost our paper signature prohibition, maybe it's time to look at that and see if it's worth attempting to put that back in place. Because when you have paper signature, it encourages signature collection that may become fraudulent signatures. And that when it becomes about the amount of money available, that's not a citizen initiative. And so if I were going to go after a couple of things to make sure that our citizen initiative remains a citizen initiative, not something driven by money from outside the state, that's, I'd start with those two.
Okay. Let me squeeze in one more question before we turn on to another issue here. Is it likely to come up again in the next legislature, this particular proposal?
Facets of it are. I don't think you'll see necessarily exactly what 1159 was, but some of the things the senator's mentioning, other people have talked about moving forward with that at this point. So I think there'll be facets of that. Okay.
Well, thank you for your candid and forthright response to those questions. And we're going to move on to another subject, the Medicaid expansion, actually. It was the only major issue that passed in 2019, it seems like. It passed with work requirements and a few other things. I'm not sure if it had a sunset clause in. I haven't read it. But I had heard originally that might come in to play. But okay, so Medicaid expansion was a nonpartisan ballot initiative that passed in the state by 61% of the vote. How did Senator Woodward, you voted no on the work requirements on this bill, the bill that came forward out of here, it had work requirements. What was your reason for that?
There are a couple of different items. It's like anytime you sit down to vote on the floor, you're looking at a lot of the details that go along with that. And there was an exclusion in there that I did not, there was an exclusion in the legislation that I did not like. So we were setting aside one group of people. And I also, we were getting down to such a small group of people in that work requirement that I didn't know if it was fiscally really going to make sense. The work requirement that was put in place, I actually don't think it's really a problem, because there's so many exclusions. If you're under 19, or if you have kids at home under 19, if you have a medical issue, or you don't have to work, of course, if you're working, or if you're enrolled in an educational program, if you're enrolled in a training program. So out of we started out with some number of 90,000 people we might bring onto the Medicaid expansion system, was the projected number for Medicaid expansion. Looked like about, with all those exceptions, and about 13,000 people might have to participate in a reporting program to say that they are working, or I was joking, calling it the Get Wet, Work, Education, or Training. Didn't take off like the New Deal. But that 13,000, then what people who were in opposition to that, the work program, said that half of that 13,000, based on current programs in health and welfare, would not participate. So then we're talking about is 6,500 people who might not participate in the work, or wouldn't meet those requirements, and so then they wouldn't have the Medicaid coverage. But there were still other exclusions or other parts of the program that would allow you to, even if you were not in it, then you could go to the hospital and still then enroll afterward. So it just seemed like it was getting a little bit too much bureaucracy, so I held off on that.
Okay. Representative Scott, and your take on the work requirements and why it came in and how it evolved to what it is now.
So the work requirements, how I understand it, and we went through it in detail within our caucus, everybody and their brother is exempted for everything. So, I mean, it really didn't have any teeth in it, but it was kind of made the Republicans feel good, I guess you could say. I mean, it seems like the only person it didn't cover was someone that was refused to work, completely healthy, laying on the couch, playing video games, and eating Fritos. Other than that, if you were like, I mean, everybody was exempt. So if you were going to school, you're exempt. If you if you're volunteering 20 hours a week, you're exempt. If you're on unemployment, you're exempt. If you're filing for unemployment, there was so many exemptions. So it really, to me, it was kind of like a feel good. So it didn't seem like a big deal to accept the work requirements. I think what we need to understand here is we want to help people that are poor pay for their insurance. We want to help people get health care and that. But the question is, where do you draw that line? And we used to draw it at the poverty level. And now we're moving that line further on down. So like, okay, this percentage, 138% of the poverty level. So what about 200%? What about 400%? Where do we draw that line? And as we keep putting more people on the system, do we want anything required to be part of that system? And at some point, no one's going to be able to pay for it all. And so that's you've got to set some standards. And so I think everyone, I mean, if you were pregnant, if you had kids, everybody was exempt from the work requirements except the Frito-eating, you know.
Or maybe Doritos.
How Doritos. About, yeah. Potato chips.
Potato chips. Okay, well, thank you. And Representative Dixon, pretty much the same thing? Or did you have, what was your take on that?
No, pretty much the same thing. I thought we needed to do something to try and manage the funds we're going to have to pay for this program and their growing costs that we'll be experiencing in the future. One of the other nice things about what we did pass and whether it sticks or not with CMS is allowing those people that are already on the exchange to stay on the exchange so they can keep the doctor that they have and not forcing them into the Medicaid system, which is very difficult and fewer physicians are taking Medicaid at this point. So it becomes a burden to everybody at that point.
Thank you.
Sarah Woodward.
Just to add a little bit to that Medicaid expansion discussion, the numbers on that, this first year that we did a budget was the expansion program goes into effect during the middle of the year. So this first budget year was only paying for half of it. And so in the budget passed this year, there was in Idaho taxpayer money, there was almost $20 million. And then to go with that, the federal taxpayer money was also appropriated. So it's close to $200 million that for the 6 months of the program. So next, when we go back for the next legislative session, then it'll be at least double that because it'll be 6 months going to a 12-month into the next budget. But we'll also start to see some of the numbers. And then if it's like other states, then more people will enroll than we were projected. And so that number gets big. I think really we've taken care of Medicaid expansion. I hope that some of the energy that accomplished that can now be turned into controlling costs. Instead of talking about how do we get everybody health insurance, how do we get the cost down? You don't buy insurance for your car or your house so that you can pay for tires or pay for gas. You buy insurance for when you wreck your car. And if you look at health insurance, we're buying health insurance to go in for the regular maintenance items because it's so expensive. So we need to drive that cost back.
Okay. We're going to have to keep an eye on the clock because we'll end up running out of time. We want to leave you each a couple minutes towards the end to summarize as well. But one of the things that did come out of the legislature this year and was approved was urban renewal districts. There was a bill, I guess House Bill 217, was signed by the governor. It restricts local governments from using urban renewal districts to fund big projects without a vote of the people. I don't know how you guys stood on that one. But Representative Dixon, what were the issues there? Because we do have a Sanpoint Urban Renewal District that's
sure.
done a lot.
I think a lot of the concern was, thank you, Chris. I'm sorry, I wasn't into the mic.
Yes.
Okay. A lot of the concern was that these are unelected boards making these decisions with tax dollars. And oftentimes they're making decisions and putting money into things that are important to them, but maybe not be very important to the citizens of a locality. So there was a lot of back and forth that did come through the Revenue and Taxation Committee. And I think the Senate amended some of it, and then we concurred with those amendments coming back. But if we're spending money, or if you're imposing taxes on people, people should have a vote on that and not be just a government entity in doing that. So I was in favor of this.
Okay. Representative Scott?
I didn't follow it in detail, but I'm always in favor of the citizens' voice being heard. So the more we get a vote, anytime you're collecting taxpayer dollars and using it for something, the people should know where that's going. It should be transparent. And so... I think that's what this bill, the intent was to do.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Woodward on that one?
Along the same lines, I think the details there were that if the project involved more than 51% of local money, when you're having most projects now are funded with some combination of sources, and if you're going to place a tax, just like our local, our hotel tax or the tax we used for the Memorial Field here in Sandpoint that went before the voters, there's a set time limit on it. Like the local option sales tax or the hotel tax, excuse me, the bed tax we have, it expires in 2026. It was voted on, and so mm-hmm. I think that's appropriate.
Okay, we are running out of time, but there's a couple more issues I'd like to talk about. And at your town hall meeting with the Republican Central Committee last week, and it was really nice. I got to watch it Facebook Live, so. The idea of a sales tax on food, it didn't pass again, and it was interesting. I think it was Senator Woodward who kind of talked about why, some of the components of why that might not have been good the way it was written, but it will come back in a better form. Is that what I heard?
Well, actually, it just didn't even happen this year because the governor didn't propose it because we had that uncertainty in we still have this uncertainty in the Idaho income tax because of those tax changes. So we knew it was not a good year to try and propose this, what is a tax cut. And so that should be definitely up on the plate next year, I would imagine. The point I always make about the grocery sales tax is that right now we all as Idaho residents, even if you file income tax or not, you can get a credit. Now that credit over time, it was a set at a fixed dollar amount and it's not raised with time. And so there are two ways to fix this problem. Either you increase the amount of the grocery tax credit that people are authorized, or you get rid of the grocery tax. The downside of getting rid of the grocery tax is that you lose a lot of outside of the state revenue. So you have to be willing to give up at least $20 million or so of revenue from outside the state. When people come here and they're buying groceries and living in a vacation rental, they're contributing to the state.
That's the explanation I was looking for that I heard on the town hall. Thank you. And then education, the bill, public school education funding formula that was being worked on. Representative Dixon, you worked on that all last year quite a bit. I think that was true. And it kind of didn't go anywhere. It kind of had the first step. The bill passed to measure key components of this new model. So where are we going to go with that? Any ideas?
I think we'll keep heading forward now. I don't serve on that committee anymore, so Senator Woodward will probably be able to speak more to that because he will see that on the Education Committee. But I know there's still a desire to move towards an enrollment-based model to clean up a lot of the line items that we're requiring schools to spend money on that they perhaps don't need to spend money on, and giving more of that responsibility to the districts who have elected board members that need to make those decisions rather than pointing to the state all the time and blaming us. So I think we'll still see movement in that direction. Senator Woodward can probably speak more strongly to that.
I just add that the intent of changing the funding formula is that the money that we spend at the state level and it better follows the students instead of following schools or classrooms so that each student is getting their fair share of the money. To make a change is painful. And so that's what you saw this year was that some people didn't want to make that change yet. But the intent of that, collecting that data, is to make an apples-to-apples comparison and then make a decision and move with it.
Okay. With that, we really need to wrap up. An hour isn't what it used to be, it seems. Just a minute or two each to give us any closing thoughts, and we'll start with you, Representative Dixon. Anything you'd like to tell folks about the year or what may be coming?
Just thank you. It's an honor to serve in this capacity, and I appreciate being able to do this for three terms now. I'm always happy to work on issues that affect us directly in District 1, and Senator Woodward mentioned a few of those that we did that were beneficial to McDuff's and working with the city of Sandpoint. We've also been working on an issue regarding Kinderhaven with our health and welfare department and making some progress with the new director of that administration, and that's always pleasing when we're able to see fruit born of our efforts there directly where we live. So I just thank you. I always appreciate this opportunity.
Yeah, we appreciate you coming in. Same to you, Representative Scott.
So I guess I want to touch on a few things. A couple of the bills that I worked on this year that did pass was a fish and game bill, just to clean up some code so it couldn't be abused for unwarrantless searches. I also worked a lot of time on a child protective services bill, which basically helps try to protect citizens of their rights when any government official comes to your door, no matter if it's a city worker or child protective services, you do not have to allow them in your home without a lawyer, without a warrant, or without consent. And so there's been a website set up for that. A couple of things I just wanted to mention, it's not enough time, but 5G is coming to Idaho. I know there's been a lot of controversy on that. That's something you should really pay attention to and make sure you understand it. There's been a lot of work towards prison reform, and hopefully with the new agency heads, we can work on some of the drug issues in our state. Vaccinations and what's happening nationally is going to be a big hot topic coming up. There's been some work on campaign finances. I guess if I can leave you with anything, if you don't get my newsletter, I encourage you to sign up for my newsletter. One of the bills that did not pass this year that has passed and throughout history is the administrative rules and regulations. And so it was a big controversy this year, and all those rules and regulations, all 8,000 pages of them, will be re-released as temporary rules. Now is the time, if there's any part of government that you are dealing with, that you are frustrated with, now is the time to make your voice heard, because all those rules will be looked at throughout the next summer. And so I would encourage you to get involved. This is the year to do it, to send in your comments. This new executive branch is looking at the rules and regulations, and this is your shot.
And how do they sign up for your newsletter?
You can text me at 208-920-3120. Or contact the station, or I'm all over, so okay. Just find me.
Yeah, just Google you.
Just send me. Yeah. Try not to email. Just text me. Okay. Thank you.
And Senator Woodward, last word from you, please.
I certainly appreciate the opportunity to serve and represent the district. What I've learned is just how helpful the people in the district are and supportive in making decisions, and that worked well throughout the session this year. Starting to generate a list for next year. And so if you want to add something to that list, just let me know.
Okay, well, thank you again for your dedicated work as District 1 legislators. We really sincerely appreciate your coming in and taking the time talking with us. Representative Dixon, Representative Scott, and Senator Woodward, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye now.